Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political left Shireen Gourvani. Hi, Shireen.
Hello. Hi, listeners. Glad you're tuning in.
And on the political right, our state auditor, John Dougal. Hi, John.
Hey, great to be with you again.
John, I was thinking about you today.
Condolences.
Are you in your second term as auditor or
third? Term.
Okay,
third term.
That's why
just
I was
celebrated
confused.
10 years.
Well, congratulations. It's nice to have an elected official on the show. And we're going to talk a lot about the legislative session today. But before we do it, can we just talk for just a minute? What about these winter storms, y'all? Are you guys just so proud of our city departments and UDOT for keeping our roads nice and clear?
Oh, so I am. I live in the Lower Abs, and there's like a big filling station, I think, for the trucks that go out and put down salt and the plow trucks. And so I see them all the time. I saw them on my run this morning, coming and going early in the morning. And I'm grateful for all of those who get out and help clear our streets.
John, I'll be at Alta.
She could have walked here, but you know.
Yeah, I'll be at Alta this weekend. My goodness, the amount of snow. I mean, it's almost getting up there where it's
last I saw it was 600 inches, and then we've had a few storms since then.
Yeah,
and a few more on the way.
I saw Carlos Braceros, who runs UDOT. I saw a tweet from him where he showed the UDOT plows going down I-15, and I think it was about six plows together, you know, where they're all going in unison.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah, I saw four this morning going on SR-92 all together in unison and stuff like
that.
Impressive. Some of them have the extended plows.
Yeah,
drop
it's
it down
impressive.
And extra wide. So it takes a lot of work.
Can I ask how your neighbors are doing and clearing their sidewalks?
Yeah, a little bit of both. Good and bad.
I've got a neighbor. He's really good. He goes out and plows lots of neighbors and stuff like that. And I have a south-facing house, so I'm lucky that I usually just wait a couple hours and it melts. Yeah.
So I just want to thank everyone who's out doing it, but I would also suggest if you see a house that is consistently not shoveling, assume first that maybe they can't. See if they could use a little help. If you can, help your neighbors out. I have a lot of elderly neighbors in my neighborhood, and just seeing, you know, people struggle to get their lawn or their sidewalks cleared can be a real challenge. So if you can help out, please do.
Shireen and John, I took great interest this week in the news about the Department of Energy with low confidence deciding that COVID-19 started with a lab leak. And it really caught my attention. Because,
it's about time. Sorry.
Well, I remember what it was like in the federal government. I helped manage the public message coming out of the Environmental Protection Agency, for example. And I know what it's like to try and get the federal agencies to move together, you know, that FDA and EPA will feel the same about, you know, mercury and tuna or something like that.
Yeah.
But when you've got these federal intelligence communities, agencies in the government all coming down differently on whether this was naturally transmitted by an infected animal or by the lab, it really just confuses the public and it takes away from the confidence people have in the intelligence communities. John?
Well, I think sometimes people assume that agencies work closer together than they really do, whether it's state or, you know, federal level. You know, I'll just bring it closer to home. We have a legislative auditor general. He and I compare notes, you know, just so we don't step on each other and simultaneously engage in the same audit. But we are not actively sitting there looking at each other's work and each other's audit before it gets released and coordinating what we're doing with what they're doing. They're independent. We're independent. And I think that's what you're seeing here at these federal agencies. They're all acting independently based on the information and their perspective and their insights to report on what they see. And so while that may cause discomfort to some, because it looks like the government's speaking out of both sides of its mouth, that can be comforting to say they're working independently, coming to different conclusions.
Well, in two words, Shireen, it's complicated.
Yeah, that's right. So I would say there are a couple of things about this that caught my attention. First is that we live in a culture where we expect to know things immediately. We want, you know, we have a large desire
so long?
To be able to
come on,
open up Google, find the answer. And when we have events like this, they are complex and there are many different factors that could be contributing. I think one thing that's important for me is what I heard is that none of these reports suggest that this was an intentional act of biological warfare and that this is really about investigating the origins of this. So there's still time, and I think we need to give people time to come to these conclusions, and that can be frustrating.
Yeah. Shireen, another issue, the Supreme Court's hearing this week about the student loan, the debt relief that President Biden provided with a stroke of a pen. One person, I don't know if it was the president or the secretary of education, but the idea that one person could spend this much money was pretty I don't know. I have a feeling the Supreme Court will not look upon this kindly.
Well, my understanding is that from the little bit of news I was able to look at today, it does sound like there are many questions regarding this. So really, we're not going to see a decision for a number of months, but they are hearing this now. And the idea was that, you know, in a national emergency, that powers were given to the Secretary of Education to be able to suspend or modify, I guess, the ways in which people were paying back their student loan debt to respond to a natural disaster. So that was used during COVID. At the beginning of the coronavirus, the student loan repayments were paused. And then this decision was made to forgive student debt. So up to $20,000, $10,000 for most people. There are many ways that I would like to see this done. I think it's unfortunate that it's going through this process, but it will be interesting to see if the Supreme Court says, no, you have to change these rules or not.
Yeah. John, do you want to say anything on this?
Well, one of the things I hate about this is it's just such a blowout of spending for certain favored constituencies. And so just politically, I think it's poor form.
It was announced in August. The election was in November, right?
Yeah,
something like that.
Yeah. And the quote-unquote folks that qualify for this, you know, can have significant income. But the other dynamic—
Many do not.
Yeah. But it's one of those things. It's one thing to say you can delay during a pandemic. It's another thing to say you're going to forgive. But when you look at this, I think one of the other things that will be interesting is the question of standing. Whether these states can truly be before the court claiming harm so the court can actually listen to it, or is the court going to use some aspect of that to avoid ruling on the broader dynamics and just focus on that? And the Biden administration, as I've seen it, appears to be trying to steer this thing, trying to avoid the states having standing,
mm-hmm.
which what I hear is the court doesn't really appreciate games like that being played. So we'll have mm-hmm. to see what happens.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. John, let's stay with you, and just I want to ask you about the Dilbert comic strip. It's getting a lot of news right now.
Is this because I'm an engineer?
Yeah.
Dilbert was like my, you know,
yeah,
one of those things that was just you had as an engineer. It's the Dilbert cartoons you
all
look forward
the time.
To. Yeah.
The creator, Scott Adams, made some racist comments on his YouTube show. They were pretty bad, you know. I mean, he called black Americans a racist hate group and advised white people to get the hell away from black people. I don't know, John, if you were like in a decision-making role with a major media outlet, would you drop the comic strip over this?
Well, I guess here's the interesting thing is we have political cartoons and newspapers will celebrate inflammatory, you know, cartoons on that page. And yet in other areas where the cartoon isn't necessarily inflammatory, but the actions of the creator mm-hmm. causes them concern. But we're living in a world in which, you know, cancel culture and other things like that, it's more you can see what people are saying when they say something stupid. And then you can see how people respond with that. And I think various businesses are concerned about those dynamics and being associated with people for different things they say and do.
I'll ask you the same question, Shereen. Would you, if you were in the decision-making role at a major media organization, would you drop the comic strip?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be associated with that.
Okay.
I just
okay.
also feel like Dilbert's not funny.
So it's an easy call for you.
It's an easy call for me. I'm not sure why Dilbert was allowed to keep going anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. You know, I have a lot of feelings about these things. I have watched as this country has wrestled with race relations and the things we've done. And I basically find that if we can talk, if we can listen, if we can get together, if we can compromise, if we can work through things, that we can get through almost any of it. But when we, I don't know, when we just kind of scream at each other, when we point fingers at each other, it doesn't seem to work.
Or when we actually try to ban books or a teaching of particular subjects, right?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's not good.
John, a lot of this is going on Capitol Hill. A lot of bills dealing with equity, diversity, inclusion programs on campuses, you know, dealing with, you know, how you hire faculty and whatnot. Have you been following that much?
A little bit. Not a lot, but
yeah.
a little bit.
I mean,
I do scratch my head because I think some of it is if we're trying to help disadvantaged students get better access to higher ed, I think there's better ways to go about it than creating a bunch of these DEI offices.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say that what I have really appreciated is there's a conversation occurring and they're going to leave it as a conversation. You don't need a bill for these things. Sometimes you can just have a study item, talk through things, and you can make a lot of progress in that way. Just a thought.
Yeah.
Hey, let's do one more issue before we drop off and talk more about the legislative session. Shireen, the UN has voted overwhelmingly to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine ahead of this anniversary. No surprise, right?
No surprise, though.
Go,
I do
UN.
Think the abstaining votes to not support that were China, if I'm not mistaken.
India.
And South Africa, right?
Yeah.
I would love to see more global unity here, but I do think certainly tensions are increasing and China is definitely a part of that dynamic.
I think, John, that President Biden is showing strong leadership. I mean, visiting the country, now sending his Treasury Secretary. Blinken's been there. You're nodding. You must be agreeing with that.
Yeah. I mean, I get some people are upset that the president didn't go to Ohio with the train derailment. I think, from my perspective, the federal government, first and foremost, has a responsibility of international issues, foreign policy. And so showing that we're strong on foreign policy, recognizing the appropriate role, I have no problem with him going there and standing with the president of Ukraine to express support for mm-hmm. what's going on, because I think it's outrageous what Russia did in attacking Ukraine.
Yeah. John, just real quickly, are you one of those conservatives that likes a lot of defense spending, strong defense?
I'm cautious on it. I recognize we need to spend it, but I understand it's kind of like once you've got those toys, you want to use them. And I use that loosely because too often, while I think we need a strong defense, we go into nation building and other things like that I think is not what we should be doing.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting in the upcoming presidential election about how conservatives, you know, fall on that. On that issue. Hey, well, in our next segment, we're going to talk about the $28 billion state budget and the Utah legislative session. Stay tuned, everybody.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gorbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. Shireen and John, I want to talk about the legislative session. We just have a couple of days left. Wow.
Congratulations to listeners who will be on the other side of it.
Yeah, amen.
Almost.
I can't imagine what it feels like to be a legislator at this point. They're going to pass around a $28 billion budget. Includes a lot of big things, includes a $400 million tax cut, $400 million towards water conservation, and an increase of nearly $1 billion for education, John.
That's a lot of money.
Shireen, a lot of money.
Yeah, so I will say I've been particularly concerned that we haven't really seen legislation that makes me feel good about the future of the lake. The $400 million towards water conservation efforts is where I think people need to be looking to see what is happening in terms of those investments going forward. I know there are a couple more bills that have emerged out of the lake to see if we can do more to preserve and help support the Great Salt Lake going forward. But what is happening with these investments is going to be critical to what we're seeing in terms of short-term impacts on the lake.
Yeah. And you know what I would say is the biggest thing we can do to help the lake is not ask the legislature to do something, but to do something ourselves. And anyway, that's just got to be a message we have to remind ourselves.
What are we going to do now? Because sign me up.
Yeah. You know, it's conserving water. I mean,
right.
it's changing your landscape. It's making long-term human behavioral decisions that recognize that we live in a desert and we need to balance our water use more wisely.
And despite all the snow we have, we still live in a desert.
Yeah, you know, one of the findings of the Great Salt Lake Strike Team was that precip had no trend, no discernible trend. And so you kind of think, oh, the surface temperature of the Earth's rising, and so we don't get as much precip. But actually, you get more rain. You just don't get as much snow, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so what they say the main trend is that we're consuming more water, consumptive uses. It's not that. So anyway, I bring that up, John, with all of the snowpack up there. Yeah, we got a big wet year. We might have another two or three, but it's not the problem. Yeah, the issue isn't that we're getting less or that we're getting more. It's that we take too much out of the system, I guess. John, anything?
Well, we have a system that's somewhat. You get penalized. If you don't use your water shares, you run the risk of losing them.
Yeah.
And so it's, I know we're working to change that.
Yeah.
You and I have also, we're fans of pricing of water. So
yeah,
you know,
we are.
You feel the true cost of what it is rather than heavily subsidized.
Yeah.
But
John, if you were to characterize this legislative session, how would you characterize it in a short phrase from what you've seen?
they were sprinting at the start.
Uh-huh.
And it really hasn't slowed down at all.
Okay.
So some of these you kind of ramp up as the session goes and you hit that frenetic pace at the end, and they were sprinting right out of the gate, right at the beginning.
And I would say that that's a function of leadership. A leadership team in the House, Senate that knew what they wanted to do, and so they put the pedal to the metal.
Right. And there were also, I think, if you go back to the school choice bill, you kind of need to lock that in if mm-hmm. you're going to work on the budget, because that mm-hmm. was a big kind of
yeah.
activity. You needed to understand how that fit in the whole scheme of things.
Shereen, do you want to characterize the session?
Oh, culture war, I would say. So when we think about everything from the school vouchers, taking taxpayer dollars and putting them into private schools. When we think about, the restrictions on teachers, the numerous bills that, frankly, I heard from a lot of teachers who felt disrespected, who feel untrusted, who feel like this is a state where they are concerned about their safety and ability to teach in their own classrooms. The conversations around books, the conversations around trans healthcare, when we think about everything, I mean, truly continuing the efforts to further ban access to abortion, which is healthcare, right? Like all of these impacts to me feel really out of line with the attitude that we like to portray about who we are more broadly. And I have to say there have been some good things happen. A version of the Florida Don't Say Gay bill was introduced by Representative Jeff Stenquist, who I was honestly pretty surprised, a person who seems to me like a person who's interested in solutions, not so interested in the culture war issues. And to see that bill basically copy and pasted and introduced here really rubs me wrong from the way that we try to portray ourselves in terms of the Utah way, coming together, working together on solutions. I'm happy to say that many of these bills have seen revisions and that the ultimate outcome, though as we're recording this, nothing is over yet, have moved to a more moderate place. But when I think about things like the fact that we have more individuals who are unhoused living on our streets, children living in poverty, people who need access to health care, people who need affordable homes, people who need to know that their school, local school, is a place where they are going to find a good educator who feels well supported. Those are some of the issues that are top of mind for me. And seeing these kind of fringe issues that are highly politicized take precedent over, I think, honestly, what most of us agree on and want to see done, including action on the lake, for example, it feels frustrating.
Ooh. I know you want to say something more, John.
I was going to say, and I tell lots of folks this, because legislators represent their various constituencies who mm-hmm. see the world very differently. And I tell folks, don't judge the legislative process by the input. Judge it by what finally happens. And I think that's a little bit of what Shereen's alluding to, is she's been concerned with the various things that have taken place. Now, she'll still be concerned when it wraps up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I tell folks, don't judge it by what gets put in. Look at what actually gets passed when the session wraps up, and then judge them based on that performance.
Yeah. You know, Shereen, I had a little bit more generous treatment of them than you do, you know, from what I've
okay,
seen.
Okay, it's no surprise, but go on.
Left side of the aisle, right side of the aisle.
I think, they've been fiscally responsible. I think that a lot of the more controversial things have been, discussed but not passed. I think that they're trying some new things, and they've got, you know, we'll yet see whether they've made the right decision on vouchers and different things. But
sure.
But my sense is, when I look around the country and I look at what some legislative bodies do, and then I look at what happened here, where we lost a lot of middle of the road legislators, and introduced this new class of legislators, and I think they've used some restraint. So,
yeah, and I should say a lot of good things are happening. There are many investments that are good. There is legislation that is good. I just want to be proud of the kinds of things that we're bringing forward and the discussions that we're having. I want people to feel like their communities are actually heard when bills are being passed about them. And I think we could do better in that
yeah.
space.
It's not, we don't know yet if the full day kindergarten bill will pass, but it looks like that there's at least some momentum towards expanding full day kindergarten. It's optional. It's something I really like. John feels differently, but that's just an example.
What do you like about it?
Well, I love structure for
yeah.
young children. And I think, at least in my case, my public school was a place of safety and a place of friendship, a place of just a really healthy place for my kids to be.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I was, a working mother, if I had the choice to have my children in full-day kindergarten versus half-day kindergarten and half-day daycare, I would have taken the full-day kindergarten in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it's really good for Utah families.
I do too.
John?
And ICON, where I'm concerned that we have too much structure for kids and there's not enough free play and letting them learn that way. And it's, okay, we've got this lesson and we've got this test and we've got this program that we're going to do and we got to do it. And so you've got that dynamic that just personally comes from my perspective. The other thing is we've done some looking at part day versus all day K. And some of the initial stuff we've seen is part day has more effective results than full day K. And I think some folks are just going down, well, if some is good, more is better, and it must be better, whether or not, you know, whatever metrics they're using to judge it.
Right. Yeah. And I think better is an interesting question here, because also as a working mom, right, when you think about the challenges of trying to find what's going to happen with that child in the second half of the day, with our lack of access to affordable childcare in the state, it really is a complicated landscape.
But that's where, from my perspective, and the broader dynamic of education, we need to step back and, is this about education or about daycare? And let's separate and discuss those two pieces differently rather than conflating it on top of each other.
I love talking about how little access to childcare we have. So happy to have the conversation.
Oh, yeah. We have a ton of it. And we call it public ed.
It's very, well, if for children, for actual babies, it's very, very, very expensive.
Yeah, well, and I would just say, I mean, I'm real into letting, you know, parents make a lot of these decisions for themselves. But I do think that we shouldn't let education be defined as bad and families be defined as good. They can both be good.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got Representative Melissa Ballard. She's a Republican from North Salt Lake. She sponsored the bill to encourage the Pledge of Allegiance in schools. This is going back to my childhood. I don't even know how this works these days, but I said the pledge every day of my public education career. Come on. You too? No? Did they do that in North Dakota?
Yeah. Yeah, they did. And then I went to Catholic school and we did that and a prayer. But luckily we could add to the prayer and I prayed for world peace every day.
John?
Well, one of the key things is I understand why they're doing this. I mean, we want to have an understanding of our country. I would suggest that really a better understanding of the Constitution is much more important from
my perspective. So reciting the Constitution every morning?
No,
interested.
Having a better understanding of the Constitution and what goes into play, because I think too often we're just going through the rote motions of saying the Pledge of Allegiance without thinking about what it really means and what the contours of it are and the challenges that we have as society and saying what is the proper role of government.
Yeah,
I'm really concerned about the phrase patriotic values, I'll say. How are we defining patriotic values? How are we thinking about the ideals of this nation? Who is defining that and how we're understanding that? I think it's a complex question that I'm afraid the complexity of those answers could eventually get banned by our state legislature. Oh, but yeah. I hope not.
Yeah, interesting. Shireen, I would love to hear you comment on what's going on with these abortion bills. Carrie Ann Lisenby has the most controversial of these. Would ban abortion clinics from operating in Utah. Your quick comment on that.
Yeah, so a couple things are happening here. We continue to live in a state that is working to restrict freedom and access to abortion care. No surprise. One of the things that's so confounding about this particular issue or this particular legislation is what it's saying is that all abortions would have to happen inside of a hospital. Well, hospitals in our state largely do not provide abortion care. So even if it's legal, this is a way to further restrict that access. The other thing we know is that it's much, much more expensive. Often, you know, regularly $10,000, in that range, $5,000 to $10,000, to perform abortion care inside of hospitals. And we know that clinics are much more affordable places where that takes place. When we think about the fact that the vast majority of abortions in our state and generally happen in the first 10 weeks and that those are with pills, right? You take pills and then the body, you know, passes the fetus. Those are very affordable. And it's a very different situation than bringing it inside of a hospital, which increases the cost and also increases demand on already kind of understaffed areas when it comes to care in our communities. So this is, I don't think this is well advised. I just think that this is the ongoing effort to try to do whatever some individuals in our state can do to try to block people's access to care that they deserve access to.
John?
I think the flip side of that is the debate, which is, when should the government step in to protect the unborn child? And where are the bounds and what is the appropriate role for the legislature or the government when it comes to that versus where isn't it? And we as society are trying to figure out those lines and those contours. But there's
And we used to have it figured out with liability.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all been torn asunder. And
but I really encourage people to go. There's been a lot of reporting really helping people understand visually what we're talking about in these early, early weeks of gestation. This is a collection of cells. This is not, as much as some of these individuals want to convince you that this is a baby, this is not. And it especially when we're talking about early interventions, I really hope that people understand, and later interventions, that many of these decisions are made with great difficulty between individuals and their healthcare providers, and it would do us all good to just have a little grace in that space and honestly allow people to make the decision that's best for them.
Yeah. We've only got 30 seconds. Let's each just give one bit of advice to legislators. I'll start out by just saying I'm going to advise legislators to don't feel a rush to pass every bill. Yeah. It's okay to let some things die. Shereen?
Hot takes on Twitter aren't, the best use of your time.
John?
Leave more to the people who govern themselves.
I love it. That's a good way to wrap this week's Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner with Shereen Gourbani and John Dougal. Program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.